From Austin Film Festival, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading creators, writers, and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week on Story, we'll hear conversations from two writer-directors from the Austin Film Festival. First up, Texas-born Trey Edward Schultz will discuss his emotional new film, Waves, starring Sterling K. Brown, Taylor Russell, and Kevin Harrison Jr.
It just gets down to a literal gut level, like what feels right, you know, and like what feels honest to these characters, this story, and this moment, leading with what spiritually feels right and not being scared to do that.
And later, we'll hear from Australian filmmaker Zach Hilditch, whose new horror film, Rattlesnake, is streaming now on Netflix.
Ultimately, I just think, like, what is exciting, but also what is emotional? And smashing the two together and then letting the story grow from there.
On Story from Austin Film Festival will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Writer-director Trey Edward Schultz's new film, Waves, traces the emotional journey of a suburban African-American family as they navigate love, forgiveness, and coming together in the aftermath of a loss. The film stars Sterling K. Brown, Taylor Russell, and Kelvin Harrison Jr. This is Schultz's third feature film. Previously, he wrote and directed 2015's Creesha, and 2017's It Comes at Night, which were also released by A24. I spoke with Schultz at the Austin Film Festival after a screening of Waves. Clips of Waves, courtesy of A24. So overall, just from a big picture perspective, you clearly had a script that you were working from, which is really spare and beautiful. Yeah. The visuals are so layered and powerful and colorful and aural and every sensual word you can use. How were you imagining that as you're writing on the page?
I'd say too, the screenplay was extremely unorthodox, and it was meant to be, that's, you know, we've used the word immersive. It was meant to feel as immersive and true to the movie on the page as possible. So the aspect ratios were mentioned, the camera movement was mentioned, fonts were big and small, and colors overtook stuff. Music was embedded in the script. So it was absolutely like I wanted the like feel in the world of the what we were striving for in the movie to come across in the script, so we could, for creative, so everyone knew that, but also just, I don't know, just be on the same page with our goal, you know.
Clearly, thematically for you, family is huge.
Yeah.
You know, can you talk about why it plays such a big role in your storytelling?
It's honestly something that happens organically. I just think it's the fact that family and my loved ones are the most important people in my life, and I love them and I'm fascinated by them, and you know, so it naturally becomes inspiration for the movies and everything. So even like for this new one, like when I was thinking about it, I was thinking how different it is from the other movies, and that, and I was thinking even more of like the love between the kids on each side of the half. But then of course I get through it, I'm like, oh, it's a movie about family again.
I'm trying to give you the tools to succeed in this world. It's not easy out there. Everything I do is for y'all. Everything.
I feel like It Comes at Night, you get a lot of the same emotional feelings as you have in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, even though they're about different things, seemingly, in a way, they still have this strong father figure. And
Well, I think, you know, it's because they're still personal movies and they're me, so they end up becoming the same thing. But when I'm starting out, like with this one, it was completely different inspirations. Well, more or less. It loops back into the family stuff again, but like a lot of stuff between like the music and Florida and not just familial love, you know, like lovers, you know, that's all new. And I don't know. I think especially just the practicalities of like the last movie was very dark and muted and intense. And not to say this movie's not intense, but it is, hopefully it's vibrant and more expansive. And I think, you know, there's a lot more hope in this film, and like it pushes through to another side. So I think it's that, but then all that stuff that's there anyways just latches onto it because that's what it is, I guess, you know.
Well, it's most definitely intense. I mean, I really felt like when I got out of the theater that I had gone on this sort of really long, long roller coaster ride, like a really, like, you know, scare and dread and excitement. And so it was all those. I mean, you're quite masterful at taking those feelings and making us all feel it in that small room, you know. And I think one of the really interesting ways that it hit me most was how every frame was filled. I mean, it was just filled. There was no space. There was no empty space.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear what your thoughts are about that from a story sense.
Yeah, well, I think a big part of it is, you know, it's about these characters, this brother and sister and this family, but it's also about the worlds they're occupying and in. So literally, just from a practical sense, it's also Florida. I'm in love with Florida. But I don't know, it was just kind of the spirit of the movie, like the macro and the micro, you know, like it could be expansive and fill the space, and whether it's just the world around or the cars or the extras or the storytelling, but also intimate and hopefully subjective, you know, because ultimately everything we're seeing and feeling is through the main character's eyes and ears. You know, first it's Tyler, then it's Emily. So that alone is a very subjective, intimate thing, but then also trying to reach bigger and combine that, because I think another thing for me with the movie, it's a lot of dichotomies, you know, it's dichotomies in our lives, and it's yin and yang, and how that and everything in the middle is kind of what we go through, you know.
The thing you do with these two parallel stories, where you literally have a story end and another story begin with like a gut punch of a scene that connects them, which also was really incredibly done. I love the camera movement in that scene, because you really felt what it must be like to be in that room.
It was the hardest thing we did in the movie. It was just Kelvin and Alexa didn't, you know, they wouldn't leave that garage till it was real, you know, or, you know, as close as you can safely do that. But it was very, very hard.
I would say normally I would consider it a device, but in this case it didn't feel like a device.
Sure.
It felt very much like a beautiful literary move, you know, that we went from one to another. And I was feeling all along that how can you pull this off? I'm going to feel like I'm in two different movies. Yeah. You know, there's two different films happening here, and yet not at all. I mean, not
Thank
at
you.
All. That had to be a risk. I had to feel
Absolutely.
Like a real risk to take that, to look at it on the page and think, can I pull this off? What was it that made you feel like this would be a great way to express the grief and, you know, horror of this family?
I mean, I think it was going through some rough things in life, you know, and when you're in those rough patches, it's all consuming and it's terrible, but then life doesn't always end there, you know, it keeps going, and you try to put together new things and grow and heal. So I think it was that. It was very much, that was always the spirit of the movie, of it's almost like a panic attack seizes in on you, and that happens, and then you get over that panic attack, and I hope it feels like the movie tries to give you a bit of a hug and get you through it, and like let's figure this out, you know, and grow from it.
Lord knows I've held on to way too much hate in my life, but all we have is now.
So it was just the DNA of what it was, but it was still, you know, it was risky. I even remember when we finished shooting the movie, producer and myself, we were like swimming in the ocean. We were like, is it gonna work? I think I also have to say, I think a huge part of why it works is I think Taylor Russell, who plays Emily, is amazing. And she, I think you, at least I, myself, like I go with her, and like she becomes the new heartbeat and pulse of the movie. So to me, ultimately too, it's just exciting. You know, I love and get inspired by movies when it feels like they're trying to do something different from what I've seen before. So I think ultimately I'm just trying to do that. I'm trying to do that, but also be honest to like the personal experiences kind of, and like bring some truth in it, if that makes sense.
You talk about Emily as being the heartbeat of it, and that's really, it's really felt. Lucas Hedges, though, is phenomenal as well.
He's
great. The two of them together have this magic on screen that, you know, that made me remember that, oh, maybe there were some moments of high school that weren't so bad.
Yeah.
Because they sure seem to, you know, give you that spark. And the journey that they took really was quite beautiful, too. But that takes me to this, you seem to have this horror sensibility, even within that. I mean, I was there was a scene in that hospital room that was genuinely it was scary to me. It was really scary, you know, and there were a couple of those scenes when, you know, the scene at the party, you know, when he walks in and his, you know, sister sees him, that was terrifying. I mean, it was, I didn't had no idea what was going to happen, but it was terrifying. Yeah. And the same in the hospital room. So what is it that drives you? I mean, were you a huge horror fan? Was this just something that, I mean, that's your sense of dread and terror here is pretty, is pretty interesting.
I dig horror movies. I don't, they're not the only thing at all. Honestly though, I think it's trying to be honest to, what that experience is like for those characters. You know what I mean? So like, at times in my life, it's felt like a horror movie. My life has been horrifying at times. And I think at times in this movie, for these characters, that's what it feels like.
I thought something else that was really lovely in there in your visuals. And your visuals were just, God, they're so expansive. You showed Florida in a really romantic way. You know, you don't usually see Florida as seedy Florida. You know what I mean? I don't know why it's always in people's brains that way. But but you did show some really beautiful places there, which inspired some of that magic, I think, between the Emily and Luke. And the manatees, you know, were, I mean, I just thought those were brilliant moments to make us all sort of feel we were in this magic romance, you know, happening. So I guess I want to talk now about these other elements you use to really make these scenes even much more powerful, which are the audio and the lights. You did some stuff on Malick films, right? Mm-hmm. On Terrence Malick films. Mm-hmm. So how much did that inspire some of this risk-taking with the layering of scenes and the colors and, the, you know, how did that come about?
Well, probably hugely. I mean, I had the benefit of working for Terry, and he was like one of my heroes when I came. I was like 19, and I got on a Terry Malick movie, and it was life-changing. So I think just on his love, my love for his movies just naturally seeks its way in, and I'm not even thinking about it or drawing upon it. But then there's also the fact that, like, when I was working for him, a big thing was that he was idiosyncratic and did things in an unorthodox manner and made movies only he could make, but no one else could mess with that, you know? And if you try to do that, you're going to fail because only he can do it, but he figured out how to do it. So then that was a huge inspiring thing to me, like figuring out how I can try to do that myself. And do I have anything original or me or to bring to it? So it was making a lot of short films and trying to find that out or figure that out. But it was like the first time I had made a short film that clicked with anyone else, it did feel more singularly me.
Talk a little bit about the process there, because it is aurally overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, but it was an enhancement. It was like you dialed it up a lot, the beginning of the movie especially. And, you know, you just feel like you're going to be taken on this ride after a couple of minutes. You know it's going to go on for a while. What was your thinking that way? I mean, did you hear it that way as you were writing it? Did you hear it? I mean, I know some writers do that. And
I think so. I mean, I always heard it as like an immersive subjective experience. So, like, I think the sound is just following suit of the visuals in the sense, like, everything we're doing ultimately is just try to get you closer to whichever character's head we're following. First that's Tyler, then that's Emily. So whether it's the music in their world, the music they're listening to, or the sounds of the world, and also it's not always just naturalistic, it's what feels kind of spiritually true.
On Story from Austin Film Festival, we'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with a conversation with filmmaker Trey Edward Schultz, whose new film, Waves, follows a South Florida family dealing with a shocking tragedy.
We wanted to make it just really dynamic and immersive that felt true to these characters, you know? So in Tyler's world, there's a lot going on, you know? So we wanted the sound to feel what it's like in his head, if that makes sense. And then when Emily takes over, her world has just fallen apart, you know? It's a different approach. But then at the same time, that's all, it's how we use rear speakers too. Like sometimes it's panning dialogue and music around with the camera, but then sometimes it's just sitting on a bench with two characters for a conversation and putting atmosphere in the rears, trying to make it feel like you're sitting on that bench with them. So it's all essentially just to get you closer to their experience.
So how did that work in the editing room though? I mean, there must have been a lot of trial and error and a lot of getting a sense of it in that room compared to seeing it with an audience and that sensibility, because that's something, it's much easier when you're cutting picture, I think.
Yeah. I edited for a while, then brought on my boy Isaac Hagee, who's amazing. And we did, we set the simple tone for what we would go for with the sound, but ultimately, I mean, I have to give everything to Johnny and his team. So in the editing room, it's more just tonal at that point, like calibrations of the tone and writing out the tone, and then you just push it further in either way once you get to the sound element, you know, and specifically focusing on that.
So you were really spare with dialogue. Some of the pieces, though, that were so clear, like, for instance, guilt, the feelings that people were feeling, which you thankfully didn't express, you know, with expository language. You know, it was really, I think, a much more powerful emotion to feel those things the way they're feeling it. And the guilt one in particular, I was really interested in because it came across without her ever saying it, obviously. You could tell that. It was like the foreshadowing of, you know, that scene where she actually sees him come into the room, you can see it working through her system visually, you know, and that's fascinating.
That was the goal.
Yeah. So, I mean, and another thing that I, wonder how you were envisioning these feelings in a literary sense and then through your actors, like what was that direction like to be giving them? Because could you catch all that really on the page of your script?
That was the goal, you know, even if we're not saying things with dialogue, it's sort of trying to take the liberty in an honest way to convey what that character's going through, you know? So honestly, and it's very collaborative and I have amazing actors. So, it's always my goal, you know, cause it's cinema first, it started silent. And like, my dream is like making a movie with as little dialogue as possible and telling your story with, visually and sonically. It's just having amazing actors and them getting the material, but then elevating it by bringing themselves and in that collaboration.
So you had a couple of these scene layering places where you're literally building, rather than us moving visually into the next scene, you're taking us in there with the audio from something before or after. Again, that's a risk, you know, is your audience going to get it? And had you seen that somewhere else? Was it something that just came through? Like where did you get the idea to do that?
I think it's just, it feels right. You know what I mean? And half the stuff we do, it just gets down to a literal gut level. Like what feels right, you know? And like what feels honest, these characters, this story in this moment. And you're sussing that out every step along the way, leading with what spiritually feels right and not being scared to do that, you know?
Well, that gut level and intuitiveness doesn't usually come across in people's scripts, I don't think.
Sure, yeah.
So I feel like you're talking about something that's very difficult for most people.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the way you're writing is really how you kind of process the world in general? I mean, do you feel like it's more instinctive and intuitive?
Absolutely. I think so. They're personal movies, you know, and it's putting all of my heart and soul and feeling into them, so it's all going to be filtered through that. So like the writing's as collaborative as it gets, you know, and all this stuff, like ultimately it's filtered through that.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit about that courtroom scene, because that was the toughest moment in the whole movie.
Oof.
And I wasn't really expecting that, and you're not even really sure that's where, you know, they're going.
Yeah.
And you just sort of end up there, and the way that was handled with both families was to me, sort of the theme of the film, which was, you know, the horror of tragedy, and then the experiencing that moment from both sides in that sort of circular way with that audio. It was just really incredible. And
thank you.
But I was surprised that scene was there.
Yeah.
So what was your, you know, thinking and putting it in there? You know?
A lot of things. I mean, I think one huge one is a practical sense of, you know, a baton pass is happening and a new character's overtaking it. And that scene, especially where we're filtering into her point of view and letting go of a character we were just living with for a while. Like, literally, the movie's like, he's gone.
I'm the one who's trying to hold this family together. Come on!
You pushed him!
What a difference.
Tyler, I'm sorry.
Tyler, stop!
So there's that, and then, I mean, I think it's just, it's being honest. Like, this is, in my opinion, the biggest tragedy that could happen to this family. So, and not shying away from that, because I think, I like to think there's hope at the end of the movie, and there's a lot of other stuff, but I don't think you earn that if you don't try to show the tragedy and the bad in an honest way as well, you know? So, it, I mean, for me, it's devastating. You're hearing a mother make the sounds that a mother should never make. And it breaks my heart. And Renee broke my heart. We were crying filming that whole scene every day. Or that day we were filming. And we just wanted to, like, be a fly on the wall and make it as real and true as possible.
Was film what you were wanting to do originally? Or
basically, I loved movies as a kid. I would make movies with my friends. One of my friends is here that we made movies together with. And I'd film family reunions and try to edit them into little movies. But then, you know, I went off course a little bit, got obsessed with sports and other stuff, and then tore my shoulder wrestling. And then that year I remember seeing, actually, There Will Be Blood in the theater, and it blew my mind and rocked my world. And I was like, this is what I have to be doing. I went to Texas San Marcos for a year for business management, but I couldn't stop thinking about movies. And then, very long story short, I went to my aunt Krisha in Hawaii, and she got me on commercials to intern on. And then I lucked out and got on a Terry Malick movie for second unit footage. I was an intern that knew nothing, and then the film loader taught me how to load magazines. It was IMAX, and then, you know, I did okay, and the DP liked me, and he got me on the other shoots, and I decided I'm not going back to school. I'm going to see where this goes. Yeah, and then long story short, I did that for a few years. Well, I'd do that, then I'd get back home, and then I interned in Austin for a bit for Terry. I interned for a few days on, like, a Jeff Nichols thing, but then throughout all of that, I was going back home and basically broke, working for my dad for money and doing my own kind of film school. In my first movie, Krisha, her main room in the movie was like my film school. I watched all my movies there. I'd rewatch them. I'd actually, too, for writing stuff, I remember watching like all of Bergman's Scene from a Marriage, but writing out all the dialogue.
Really?
Yeah, because I'd read scripts and stuff, too, but it didn't, I don't know why, it felt better, like, actually trying to write it and from their language and, like, learn from that. Yeah. And it was just a lot of that. It was obsessed for years. And objectively, I probably looked crazy. I was living with my parents for too long and broke. And I'm going to be a filmmaker in, like, Montgomery, Texas. And everyone's like, you're insane. You have no future. But I just kept going after it and then trying to make short films and learn from them. And then it finally felt like it started to click with my short film, Krisha. And yeah, and I mean, now we're here. That movie, basically, all the fantasy dream happened. It changed my life and gave me new opportunities. And then I got to make my second movie. And that, so from that moment on, I feel like I'm just in a rush to make these movies before I'm not allowed to.
Next up, a conversation with writer-director Zach Hilditch. Hilditch's new film, Rattlesnake, is a psychological horror film about a mother wrestling with the morality of paying a debt to a mysterious woman who saved her daughter's life. The film is now streaming on Netflix after having its world premiere at the Austin Film Festival. Hilditch spoke about writing and directing the project with author and filmmaker Owen Edgerton. Clips of Rattlesnake, courtesy of Netflix, and Campfire. Clips of 1922, courtesy of Netflix, and Campfire.
I wanted to ask you, that this one's based in Texas. As an Australian filmmaker, why'd you choose Texas as the location?
Well, yeah, it all goes back to my very first inkling of an idea of what to do with this setup and concept of a mother and child falling ill and accepting help from some sort of entity that then has a cost. That very seemingly simple premise was in my head for 2 years, and I never really knew what to do with it. But that initial concept, it always, because it was about being stranded in the middle of nowhere, to me, it was definitely something that I wanted to explore in the middle of America, and therefore I had to choose somewhere, and it definitely should have been Texas, because even as a kid, my ideas of Americana are based in open desert roads, and big blue skies and canyons, and just that vast emptiness that's hauntingly beautiful. So it was always that imagery as a writer-director. I'm writing and I'm also doing the other job as well, figuring out, where would I put the camera? So those images were always burned in my brain attached to the idea. So when I decided it should be Texas and I managed to flesh out what should happen in the rest of the story, I had to choose a town. And I just started researching Texas towns, ones that are obscure enough and small enough to make sense. And Tulia was just such a beautiful name. It was like a flower. And then sure enough, when I researched Tulia, it's actually got a real dark underbelly. Yeah. And there's a documentary about this town. And it's got a real shady bunch of dealings that have gone on there. So I knew it was the perfect kind of place to choose, because it was a beautiful sounding word. But it was just, it's so dark already that I then embellished a little bit what Tulia actually looks like, given we didn't shoot it in Texas. We shot it in New Mexico. But, we had a few flowers is there because my production designer went out to the real Tulia and spent some time there. And it is, talk about small, the town you see in the movie is like a metropolis compared to the real Tulia, which is very tiny.
So you made two films with Netflix. Oh yeah, well, how's that experience going?
Oh, amazing. On 1922, the Stephen King adaptation I did, that was my first taste of it. And, this is, we shot it in 2016, so we shot it 3 years ago. Everyone was just sort of figuring things out, and they were just... Ross Dynasty, my producer, had a golden run with them at the time. He'd done about four under $2 million indie thriller horrors at Netflix. And when I adapted 1922, I sent it to him. No one wanted to touch it. Ross said, I love this. I don't want to change a word. And I've got a thing with Netflix right now. I want to take it there. And I was like, get me on a plane.
So tell me a little bit about how you kind of got started, even before these final hours.
You've got to make your own luck. And you've just got to have that thing ready just in case.
Yeah.
And the 1922 story with that script, there's been other things like that that have broken my heart, where you think, that's not that at all, because it just, for whatever reason, it just fell over, So, it is the exception to the rule when you do get one up, because it's oh my God, we did it. And then the next 10 after that will all fall over. And then maybe the next one, a rattlesnake, won't,
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I went to film school in Perth, Western Australia, where I'm born and bred. Did a 4-year film degree there. And within that, incubation system of being surrounded by your friends and pals and cinematographers and editors and actors and just getting to really try things out, it's just such a great breeding ground, and you meet like-minded people. But then when you leave that system, it's begging, borrowing, and steering to just keep making stuff.
Yeah.
Shorts, zero-budget features. You can go to the government, Screen West and Screen Australia, where I'm from, to get short film money. And, everyone's always going for that. There's all these pots of money that are drying up more and more, which is a shame. But... But especially when I was just out of university 10 years ago, there was a bunch of money that you could apply for. And I was lucky to sometimes get some shorts funded, sometimes not. You'd go and make them anyway and just kept as active as possible. And that almost felt like a decade of my life of just grinding away, working as many jobs as I could, making these things when I wasn't working. No one was ever getting paid on these things. And, just surrounding yourself with the small film community in Perth. But then it all goes up another level when, after you've written all these features and things have fallen over, or you didn't get development money from Screen West for this screenplay or whatever, when I wrote these final hours, it was all the planets aligning and all the gatekeepers saying, actually this, and you've done enough now with this zero budget Like, you know, what if we gave you a little bit of, like, help and money?
When 1922 came out, as opposed to your last film, which was, you know, These Final Hours, was it just bizarre to see it just, boom, all of a sudden in so many places?
Yeah, the instant eyeballs. Like, yeah. It's a scary thing in many ways as well. Like These Final Hours was pre-Netflix, so yeah. We did it the old-fashioned way. We had to sell territories. We got to travel the world, do some cool festivals, but it was a grind. You're also, like, chipping away and hoping, oh, how's it going to do in France? And how's it going to do over here? And I mean, Netflix is like click of a button, bang, all of that goes away, and the world is connected into the thing that you made.
Yeah. Specifically with 1922, based on the novella of Stephen King, actually novella short story, yeah. How did Stephen King feel about it? What was that like? I know you're a Stephen King fan. What was your relationship with him before and after and now?
It's funny, like while I was in this limbo on These Final Hours waiting for the financing approval to happened from the gatekeepers in Australia. It was a real tense time because we felt like we were onto something. All roads were leading to the promised land, but we weren't greenlit yet. And we were waiting on decisions that were completely now out of our control. We'd done everything we could. And I remember vividly, I was just so distracted with it. I wanted just an escape. And I remember seeing the cover for Full Dark, No Stars, yeah. Stephen King's collection of four novellas, of which 1922 is the first story. And it was such a striking cover with this woman, like, sort of twisted, and it was black and red, and, like, I was like, wow, that's a really cool cover. And, you know, I'm not the world's craziest Stephen King fanatic, but I've read a lot of King, and, you know, like, he's Stephen King.
He's doing okay.
So I haven't read everything he's ever written, but obviously he's a master. And I was like, oh, I should read this Stephen King, because this has just come out, and, like, it looks really interesting, and it's four shorts. I remember reading 1922, and it absolutely taking me away from worrying about These Final Hours, because it just transported me to the Nebraska Dust Bowl in 1922. And I was just riveted by it. And I loved that it was so simple. It was a, you know, first-person shooter. It was like what I do. It was like it's a single protagonist, single point of view movie where you're in someone's psyche, in someone's headspace for the entirety of it, doing some bad things, you know.
In 1922, I murdered my wife, my son. Hated me. Well, this is a thing I regret even more bitterly than the crime, for the reasons that this document will show.
I just sort of immersed myself in this story, and I became kind of obsessed with it. But when I finished the story, I remember thinking, oh, Frank Darabont's going to have a field day with this one, because he'll make this. And yeah. I kept thinking, because I never even thought it was achievable to adapt Stephen King. I was like, where do I even begin? Like, and I'd never done an adaptation before either. And, you know, I got kind of frustrated with the way a few projects had gone, and I just kept thinking about 1922, and I went, you know what, like, what I really want to do is that. And so I reached out. No one even knew what a 1922 was. No one wanted to touch a movie about that was period, about a guy who kills his wife in the first sentence of the story, and then you're just dealing with the ramifications. I got King's blessing. I had 6 months to adapt it, and then 6 months to set it up as a real movie. Like, I had to prove that it was, like, on track to make maybe being made. If anything, it was just a great experiment for me to use something that was already so cinematic as my first adaptation, just to see what it's like adapting someone, and it just so happens to be Stephen King, right? So I just had to forget about that and just focus on why I loved the story.
On Story from Austin Film Festival. We'll be back in a moment.
Thank you.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with filmmaker Zach Hilditch, whose new horror film, Rattlesnake, is currently available on Netflix. Hilditch spoke about the film with author and filmmaker Owen Edgerton.
It was really fun just to figure out how you make something that's already kind of a movie, but actually physically make it a movie. And, you know, it's very faithful in spots. There was a lot of creation on my behalf to get around other spots to make it a movie and all those things that you then realize what goes into an adaptation. I did it for as a spec, like got paid nothing. It just was all me just wanting to do it. Sent it to King, and then I waited, and then I waited. And I didn't wait too long, but then you're like, I just need his blessing now before I can go and try to make it a real movie.
Oh my gosh, really? And you have to get his blessing.
Got to get the blessing. Like, he's got to read your scripts. And now Stephen King is now reading your adaptation of his story. And I remember waking up one morning and I checked my phone, and I'm not on Twitter, but someone had sent me a screen grab and said, "Hey, Zach, have you seen this?" While I'm still waiting for King to say yes or no. And it's like, Stephen King has tweeted, "Got to check out these final hours, everybody. And like, and I'm like, does this mean he liked my adaptation? Because, you know, the movie was sent to him as well, but just to, you know, make sure that I wasn't crazy. So I'm just sitting there for a day going, wow, like Stephen King just watched my movie and like tweeted about it. Amazing. And then the next day I got the call. Yeah, he's cool. Yeah, he's fine. He doesn't want to change a word. He's happy. And I'm just like, kidding me? Jesus. But then the 6 months was eaten up with everyone saying no to it. Until Ross. Yeah. But that was the roundabout way of like how I did my first adaptation, and it just so happened to be King, and yeah.
You know, you mentioned something that I've noticed in your films too, that you so often have the point of view of a single protagonist. So like in these final hours, it's almost exclusively in this one man's point of view, a little bit in the little girl's point of view at the party. And then, of course, in 1922, it's all in the point of view of the farmer. And then in Rattlesnake, same thing. What drives you, do you think, to dive into the head of a single protagonist and stay there?
It's a very subconscious thing for me, because when I write, I tend to just want to only experience things. I always, whenever I've written things that don't do that, they're just not very good. Huh. Like I seem to struggle with that. I seem to gravitate more towards, you know, what it would really be like to be in someone's shoes. Yeah. And all those little nuances, all those very particular points of view where you might miss out on a bunch of information because it was happening over there, but this person only saw a little bit of it. And that just creates a nice tension to me. Like I love movies that, yeah, don't give all their cards away, and you're not skirting around and seeing what everyone has to say about the State of the Union. I mean, I'm sure I'll start doing projects like that at some point. Right now, like that trilogy really is like single protagonists like being locked in their minds. Yeah. And watching what they do when the chips are down and when gets real.
Yeah, it's interesting to think of it as trilogy, because in each of those films, the hero, the main protagonist, is murdering someone, and it's seemingly for the first time. In each one of them, they end up killing somebody, and it seems like this is the first time they've ever had to do that. And what I love about your films is that murder is never as easy as it is in the movies, that we really kind of feel the weight of death. What's your feeling about killing people?
That's funny. I just realized that for the first time that, yeah, all three movies, because even in These Final Hours, yeah, the guy has to kill a pedophile.
He's killed that moment.
For the first time.
He kills the pedophile. Like, there's enough for us to share.
No spoilers, but but yeah, all three of them do have someone dealing with murder for the first time.
Well, I mean, Rattlesnake is primarily about that. Mm. Like, to save your daughter, you have to kill someone else. But that is her whole journey.
Such a pretty little thing. I think we almost lost her. You really are lucky. Things could have ended much differently.
You are?
I'm here to talk about your payment, Miss Ridgway.
Oh.
Why don't you pull up a chair?
So we have insurance, my daughter and I both. We're both covered.
Oh, I'm not talking about your hospital debt. I'm talking about the other debt. The one you now owe. What was done for your daughter doesn't come cheap. Her little soul was spared, and now you owe one in return.
Yeah, I think because you're already in such a heightened world in many ways with Rattlesnake, but not really, because the heightenedness is the curse.
Yeah.
But everything else, therefore, needed to be so grounded. And Katrina, played by Carmen Ejogo, who's amazing.
She's amazing.
Every decision she made had to be real. It had to be what would really happen. And that's what really propelled me writing it and made it interesting, is that I wanted to get almost hooked into the minutiae of like, oh, well, actually, in Texas, you can't just walk in and buy a gun, which is news to me when I Googled it. Yeah. So I was like, that's great, because now it's another obstacle.
Lightweight, easily concealable, but most important, accurate. Shoots a maximum 16 rounds through a flush-fitted magazine. I'll do you two boxes for the price of one. You ever fire one of those, darling?
I'll take it.
All right. I just gonna need to see your license. You're a Texas resident, I take it.
No.
Well, I'm afraid I can't be letting you purchase a firearm. Residents of Texas only.
And so just finding out, okay, she's in Tulia. What is Tulia like? Okay, well, how far is it from this thing? Okay, how do you buy a gun? Like, all these questions that you would have to deal with in her shoes was just off to the races for me as a writer, because I got to choose the most interesting ones and the different rabbit holes and decide when I wanted to zig instead of zagging, to subvert what most of these films generally do, which would involve her one-upping the entity and going, aha, actually, I'm not going to do it, because I figured out for the first time in anyone being stuck in this curse, and if you do this over here, I win, you know. You know, there was no reprieve. She gets stuck in this situation and she has to commit. So then the question is like, who is it going to be, and can she do it? Not will, it's like, can she physically like do it? And she really struggles, because she's a human being. And I would imagine, as I wrote the film, it's very hard to kill someone, no matter who they are.
I was thinking about, and maybe this is again with the trilogy, you have this beautiful palette of colors in all your different films. And you also have, I suppose you'd say, a palette of light. Traditionally, horror movies are at night and they're scary. And 1922 definitely has those moments of night, and Rattlesnake has darkness that plays into it. But actually, the majority of the film is bright. It's day, and it changes. In these final hours, it gets more and more red, I suppose, as the fire's approaching. How do you deal with light when you're writing your script and preparing? What is your relationship story-wise with light?
Well, as a writer, I love being dictated to by the story, by the setting, by where are we? Is it day or night? And why is it day? Or why isn't it night? And letting, if it's a wintry day or if it's a hot day, like infiltrate the very story, you know, like using heat as an obstacle if it's a summer day, you know. These final hours, it's constantly getting hotter, so things aren't working, and everything's getting harder for this guy on the last day on Earth. So I love being dictated to by the very thing you've written, rather than writing something that kind of could be anywhere or be any time, because then you, as a director, you're there and you're like, huh, so what should this look like? I love knowing going into the movie, it's like, oh no, it's always going to be getting hotter. These final hours is going to be yellow, orange, and then red. That's the way the movie's going to look, and it's broad daylight the whole way. Rattlesnake was, again, a ticking clock set during the day movie, but a different kind of, I guess, a more subtle twist on it, because like it doesn't change too much, but constantly having these horrific images and these little flashes of violence and moments like that in beautiful broad daylight was a nice sort of juxtaposition for me. Because in 1922, we got to really play with darkness whenever the sun went down, and we're in that house. Whoa. And just the rich textures of the wood in that real house, and like the way Thomas Jane looked and everyone's costumes, like that brownness, that earthliness was definitely what that's why I thought that Frank Darabont was going to do it, because I was literally watching a Frank Darabont movie when I read that story. So I just went in with a Darabont agenda. I was like, well, let's do what he does with a little bit of There Will Be Blood and we should be all right. I think that is important when you're writing too, that it's almost already laid out for you exactly what colors you're seeing, what kind of heat you're experiencing, or just what sort of weather you're even mixed up in. You know, it just affects everything.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, because like 1922, the wind is such a part of that film. And I love that you're letting the story lead the way in that way. You mentioned something then too about ticking clock. And I noticed in all these films, you do a brilliant work. And I think as writers, it's such a brilliant tool of the ticking clock. Of course, in these final hours, last 12 hours of life on Earth, and then in Rattlesnake, Sundown, and then even in 1922, the sort of rats, the rats coming in, knowing that our storyteller is soon going to be devoured in some way. How do you play with that? Are you sort of moving into that on purpose, or is it almost like a natural thing that comes when you're writing the story of adding a ticking clock?
Yeah, I guess 1922 had almost a ticking clock. I guess 1922 is different to the other two, given that the two are literally just two, like a day and a day, whereas 1922 is kind of a bit, it's almost like months.
Yeah.
But there are stretches of it that are like the sheriffs come in and whatnot, and it was actually good to sandwich, you know, that one with the other two, because there are similarities structurally with Rattlesnake and These Final Hours. But ultimately, yeah, adding the ticking clock to Rattlesnake was just very important because, like, I wanted everything to be so simple so that I could cut to the chase, exploring her psyche, doing the thing she needs to do. So I needed the rules to be so clear and so set up. And again, I don't involve myself in ever explaining to a character in the story world why this is happening, because sometimes just happens and you get mixed up in something and you don't, and things don't make sense.
Yes.
Like running around in a war zone, kids don't understand why bombs are dropping, and then it's apocalyptic all of a sudden and they don't understand. I love following characters who are just dealing with aftermaths of things, or in situations that they don't fully understand, but you need to give the audience just enough, obviously, so their heads don't explode with like questions. So with Rattlesnake, it was trying to just shade in just enough so that I could just focus on someone who is confused and doesn't understand why this is happening to her, but she understands she has to commit to what she's been told to do to get out of it. So with Rattlesnake, just putting a ticking clock on it just felt like the best way. And why? Well, we'll never know, but maybe I can lean into some mythology with sun gods and like weird silhouettes and deserts. And there's just so much sun paraphernalia and shots of the sun and reflections and just that ethereal quality that I wanted to keep going, almost like a ghostly, you know, thing always hanging over this character's head. That involved the sun and the sun moving.
When you're going for a scene that has like a necessary, like she's got to get a gun, you're going to make it feels like this distinct world with a distinct story. I mean, Rattlesnake is a great example. Like, again, visually, like, what, this is art in the background. There's references to torture in Iraq. Well, there's all these different things that are happening that are never talked about but are a part of it. How do you approach that on the page?
I just created this crazy backstory for the gun salesman because I knew that when we get to this location, I want it to be different to the other. There's only so many houses, there's only so many diners, there's only so many places you can have scenes happen in the town. And I thought, okay, what about a chop shop? What if it's like some sort of chop shop pseudo like artist residence for this gun salesman? And just have all these really interesting elements just in the background that are never even explained. They never even get their own close-up. It's just, they're just there. Yeah. Like, anywhere we could put a bit of the real world in this movie, like with Tony Robbins, with right. that, with the female Bellator fights, just anything that could be real, like Patsy Cline, like just grounding it as much as we could in reality was important, because every decision Katrina's making is a real-world decision that just so happens to be surrounded by a larger-than-life curse.
You ever handle one of them before? Because if you need some pointers, I offer that for free.
No, I'm a...
Who's the unlucky son of a...
What?
They got it coming? You out to end someone. I can see it in your eyes plain as day. So, I want to know. I want to know, Katrina Ridgway, that you're sure they got it coming.
So much of what I love about horror is an exploration of the uncanny. Or maybe not even necessarily an exploration, but just the uncanny. An image that doesn't make sense and rattles me in a way. And I noticed a lot of that in Rattlesnake. How do you tap into the uncanny?
when I was in film school and just after, I was doing a lot of kitchen sink dramas because that was what you did in Australia. Like, that's what got into festivals. That's what we learned in film school. You had to learn from the greats, like, you know, relationship dramas and drug addicts doing things. And, you know, like Amores Perros was a big influence on me and just a lot of world cinema. So, you know, you start replicating that. But then, you know, so there was a big shift where this little thing called elevated genre became a thing. And I realized that a lot of my favorite movies were elevated genre, like 28 Days Later and, you know, 12 Monkeys, like intimate personal character studies that just so happened to be, like, you know, based around a zombie apocalypse or time travel or whatever. And I realized, oh, that's actually stuff that audiences probably do want, and that's stuff that I watched as a kid. And that's, you know, so you sort of go through these weird phases where I went and did the kitchen sink dramas only to then make the ultimate, like, Last Day on Earth kitchen sink drama, which is basically you take away the last day on Earth, and it is a kitchen sink drama about a guy who's not ready for parenthood. And what's he going to do? And he's got two girlfriends, and he's like, what do I do?
Have the exact same day and just not have the end of the world at all. Yeah.
So now you throw him onto the Last Day on Earth with that same problem, and it becomes, to me, such a more palpable, interesting, intriguing, complex story. And, that's no different to 1922. And then, again, with Rattlesnake, it's a mum starting over with her daughter, and we never really fully find out what happened there or why, but she is, and then it doesn't take long before one flat tire and one mistake getting off the freeway that she should never have gotten off turns her whole life around, and she has a little detour and her life goes on pause for a moment.
You know, Poppy taught me how to change a tire. One day I'll teach you. Meantime, you should probably come over here and get a head start and pay attention.
Yeah, that's boring.
Yeah, suit yourself. Maybe you can help by getting Mommy her coffee.
So that uncanniness, I think it's it mostly comes from first a place of character, but I also mostly think in situations. Yeah. And I think the uncanny genre aspect and a character, things always are a situation first. The genre is almost an afterthought.
Really?
Because, yeah, the situation inevitably has a bit of a mix of a genre on it. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I just think, like, what is exciting, but also what is emotional? And smashing the two together by coming up with situations. Situations that get my gears into overdrive, where I can't stop thinking about that character in that situation, and then letting the story grow from there.
On Story is part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, the On Story radio program and podcast, and the On Story book series. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, and the Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. On Story is supported in part by Two Farm Media, immersive story experiences by Rich Chaparro. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Colin Heyer, Sonia McCarter, and Maya Perez. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Audio capture by Travis Kennedy. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from The Sound Lab, Inc., Travis Kennedy, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about Austin Film Festival and conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.